We have two cases today. Our first case is United States v. Bahan. Major Blythe, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Hoff, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Matthew Blythe, and together with my co-counsel, Major David Bosner, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Melody Bahan. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve
Could you please pull the microphone more towards you?
Yes, sir. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, with your permission.
Granted.
Thank you.
And I just need to have you keep your voice up a little bit so people can hear.
Yes, sir. Sentence comparison ensures sentence uniformity, and that uniformity is a key aspect of the CCA's sentence appropriateness mandate. Lacey is a sensible and workable framework for comparing sentences and is especially important in cases like this, where CM and Airman Bahan engaged in the same or similar misconduct, and despite his greater culpability and higher grade, he receives no confinement, no punitive discharge, and a fraction of the forfeitures. Lacey is the solution to this problem. Moreover, applying Lacey and post-docketing sentence comparison here is consistent with the Brennan line of precedent that this court recognized in Jesse. Issues that arise within the record of trial but are not fully resolvable thereby. This court should continue, consistent with Jesse, to allow the CCAs to engage in post-docketing sentence comparison. This court should then turn to the merits of the case and decide that the Air Force Court erred abused its discretion when it held these inextricably linked cases are not closely related within the meaning of Jesse. I'd like to begin with why this is permissible under this court's precedent in Jesse and Article 66.
Can I please first turn your attention to the second issue having to do with Lacey?
Yes, sir.
Now, with that, the court in Lacey provided three categories. They went through them. And it's clear from your brief that you feel that they were co-actors in a common crime. And it's apparent that you're saying there is a direct nexus. Are you also saying that the second category, the common or parallel scheme, applies or no?
Well, Your Honor, I think for the two drug offenses, for the use offenses, we believe they'd be co-actors. The Air Force Court said that it was a common plan or scheme. We still believe that it would fall under as co-actors because they procured it together, used it together at the same time. So I think that would fall under the co-actors.
And from your perspective, you're acknowledging that when it came to the fraudulent enlistment issue in particular, as well as the false official statement, that they were not co-actors on those particular offenses.
That's correct, Your Honor. And for the false official statement to the OSI, we think that there remains a direct nexus there for comparison in that the origin of that offense was that they were caught together or had a roommate report on the two of them using drugs together. In part of the same investigation, they both lied in different ways to protect themselves.
So we've got those cases, hypothetically, where there is a precise overlay, not only of the offenses charged, but the actual acts. Then you've got a case such as Wacha or Waka, however it's pronounced, where this court found that there wasn't a sufficiently close relationship between the cases so that the sentence comparison didn't apply. So in that scenario, doesn't it show that there is some play in the joints here? In other words, there is discretion to be exercised by a CCA in deciding whether they're closely related under Lacey. And if you accept that premise, how does this court then determine that there was an abuse of discretion in this particular case?
We are acknowledging that the holding in Waka, we think this is not one of those closed cases. So in Waka, only four of the 16 specifications overlapped. Here we argue three out of four. We acknowledge that the fraudulent enlistment is separate and apart, but it's still important to keep that in mind for the comparison when looking at overall what are the offenses and is there a high disparity between the sentences. For the offenses here, they have the four same specifications, essentially. And then he has the greater misconduct of distribution, which I argue is probably the strongest of any specification on any of the charge sheets, and he nonetheless receives a greater punishment. So here we have maybe the fourth, the fraudulent enlistment specification would not fall by itself into the category, but the problem is that doesn't eviscerate the existing connection between the offenses and the offenders.
So would you like this court to provide any additional guidance in terms of how CCA should examine these cases? If you're saying this was an abuse of discretion, are you saying that there's something else we should be saying that would allow the CCAs to know what, whether a specific case coming to them in the future should be deemed closely related or not? Or are you saying, just look to Lacey?
Well, Your Honor, I think what we would ask this court to say is that there is not a requirement for a total overlap in every specification and the way that it occurs. Not just that it's the same type of specification, but that it occurs together. I think that's the government's position here, and I think that's a fair reading of the Air Force Court's opinion, is it required essentially that every one of the specifications would have factual overlap in how it occurred. I think that's a misreading of Lacey, and I think that the court should say that that's not what's required under Lacey. Lacey provided three examples. It was a non-exhaustive list of what could make cases closely related, but to say that some difference in the charges undermined the existing connection, I don't think is a fair reading of Lacey, and some of the CCAs that have looked at that have reached the same conclusion. Blow is the case we cite in our brief that mentioned this court has never held or suggested that some difference in the charge sheet means that an otherwise closely related case is no longer closely related. The Navy Marine Corps Court of Appeals, two cases essentially held the same thing, looking at some differences in the charge sheet didn't undermine whether or not the cases were closely related.
So let's say that this court were to adopt that approach. You've got false official statement, you've got a fraudulent enlistment, both of which are serious offenses. You also have the drug offenses. Can you really focus in a little bit on why it was an abuse of discretion on the part of the CCA to say, you know what, when you've got these two other significant offenses out there where there was not a co-actor relationship, not some other direct nexus, they determined that it weren't closely related. How do we say it's the abuse of discretion standard was fulfilled?
Well, yeah, I think we would say that three of the specifications, all but the fraudulent enlistment, would satisfy the test under Lacey, and just having one separate apart doesn't undermine that pre-existing relationship between them. I think that the gravamen of the case is the joint use of drugs. And so I think it's abuse of discretion for the Air Force Court to say that these additional offenses, or the additional offense of the same type, is enough to undermine the pre-existing condition. So I think it's faithful to Lacey, and not much of an extension to hold that.
Major Blythe, along the same lines, should the lower courts, the service courts, consider form selection? For instance, in this case, one accused went judge alone and the other accused went with members for sentencing. Or is the pursuit for relative parity in sentencing, does that render form selection irrelevant? You know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that it's key for the rational basis for the disparity, if there's a reason for it. I don't think that the form selection should play into that. The government at most cites to a concurrence from the Durant case that suggests that, but all that Judge Sullivan said there was that that can explain some difference in the cases, but it can't explain high disparities by itself. And to the degree this court has interpreted the legislative history to say sentence uniformity is one of the CCA's responsibilities, this court has never suggested that that is true, except if someone goes members, in which case we're going to review it under a different rubric or a different standard.
Thank you.
So I'd like to turn to why this is permissible under Article 66 and under Jesse. And it has to do with how the facts of this case fit within the second Brennan line of precedent, where it's raised in the record of trial, and it's raised extensively in the record of trial. CM's participation is detailed in the stipulation of fact, in the care inquiry. Erin Bohannon details his role and her relationship with him. They were in a relationship together at the time. MS testifies about CM's role during pre-sentencing. It's even in Erin Bohannon's unsworn statement as well. And so it is clearly indicated there's at least a prima facie case within the record itself that there's a a direct nexus between these offenses. And the outstanding question...
But we don't know anything about what happened to CM and SM and MS in terms of being charged, in terms of being court-martialed, in terms of what they pled, in terms of what they were convicted of, in terms of what their sentences were. None of that is in the record, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, so when you say that I can't remember what the phrase you just used, but you said, you know, you're talking about their actions maybe are replete in the record, but we don't know anything about what happened to them in terms of being charged and convicted or sentenced for their alleged crimes, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think to respond...
So if the burden is on the defendant, or here, appellant, to raise this issue, to establish a prima facie case, why is it just sufficient that there's evidence in the record that they participated, that they took actions? We don't even know if they were ever even charged, right? Not from the record, we don't. So how is that enough to establish a prima facie case that there is sentence disparity?
I think that what this court recognized, the Brennan line of precedent, was that there are certain extra record factual determinations that are going to be necessary predicates to resolving appellate issues, and the CCAs are charged and required to engage in sentence comparison in these type of cases. And I think that's the natural question.
Well, that gets to the question of, like, how did this, you mentioned in your opening that this was a duty, a part of Article 66 that the CCAs are required to engage in. I mean, that seems, if we started out, this line of cases started out saying, generally, no, they should never do this except in rare instances when there were exceptions. It seems like your position is that those exceptions have now swallowed the rule and that there is a duty or a burden on the CCAs to investigate, to go and search out whether the co-actors might have been charged, might have been convicted, might have been sentenced, just off the fact that they exist. We know that they existed, they took some part in the facts of the case, therefore they have a burden then to go and search out that information?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it's an affirmative obligation on the CCAs to do so. We still, appellants, bear the burden of demonstrating closely related and that the sentences are highly disparate, but I don't think it's swallowed the rule in the sense that they have to engage in sentence comparison. This is a very limited exception that Lacey applies to, and it's a very difficult test for appellants. I mean, the record overwhelmingly since 1999, since this court decided Lacey, is one of failure for appellants, of failing to meet those first two prongs in the analysis. But in doing so, appellants have nonetheless used post-hoc and sentence comparison, looked at sentences that arose later or raised them to the CCA for the first time in order to meet their burden. And so I don't think as the government says, it's not unworkable. It hasn't been a problem. If it was unworkable, it would have demonstrated itself to be so over the past 24 years since this case was decided. And most of the time, when appellants raise this issue, they lose on being unable to prove that cases are closely related or the sentences are highly disparate. I think this is definitely the outlier of a case where we have overlap in the offenses, closely related case where the sentences are highly disparate. And
if all that were true, then why weren't these issues raised to the convening authority? Why not say to the convening authority, hey, look, two of these court martials have already happened. There's one pending. You should wait for that one, which I think this convening authority has the authority to do under RCM 109. So why not, 1109, excuse me, why not raise that issue? Isn't the convening authority the exact right person, the best person in this case, to make an initial determination whether or not there were disparate sentences here? And then I think fairly, I'll just to put all my cards on the table, I think you could well argue that, like, it's raised by the record. This fits right into Jesse bucket two, right, of an issue that's in the record. But here none of that was done, right?
That's true, Your Honor, but I think that at one point that would be sufficient because the convening authority had both more power and more time in order to consider these. In the case here, MS and SM, we're not asking, we don't think that they fall under Lacey because they wouldn't satisfy the first two prongs of the analysis. But when we look at how close in time these two cases are, January of 2021 is when Aaron Bohannon's court-martial is. CM's court-martial is 1 month later. And in that limited window, her EOJ closes out and it's done. I suppose that she could have asked to extend the clemency window in anticipation that maybe he'd get a lower sentence, but that seems like something that I don't think a convening authority would grant, knowing that they have no idea what's going to happen in the next sentence. And in many cases...
But even so, wouldn't that easily trigger Jesse Bucket 2? Like, I asked the convening authority, please compare my sentence to the outcome of my co-actor. And if he does, fine. If he doesn't, fine. But then the issue's in the record, right?
I think it's true, Your Honor, and that would be a cleaner case if they raised it to the convening authority. But I don't think that the failure to raise it to the convening authority means that it eliminates it from the Brennan category. I think it's extensively documented in the record of trial, his role. And, again, it leads to the inevitable question of what was the result for him in order to engage in the required sentence comparison. And, Your Honor, I see my time has almost expired. Benny, any questions?
Any further questions from the bench? If you want to conclude with your last 29 seconds, please do.
Your Honor, I think that a full analysis of the under stare decisis factors also heavily weighs in favor of retaining post-docketing sentence comparison. Whether it's workability, the reasoning of the decisions, no intervening events have changed the analysis, and the reasonable expectations of service members, as well as the public perception of the military justice system, all weigh in favor of retaining post-docketing sentence comparison.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Captain Hoff.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Olivia Hoff, and together with Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States. Appellant is not entitled to a windfall from CM's sentence for three reasons. First, because the plain language of Article 66 and this court's precedent in Jesse limit the ability of the CCA to review extra record materials not attached to the record at docketing. Second, all four stare decisis principles support limiting the CCA's review in this manner. And third, even if this court allows review of those extra record materials, then the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals appropriately decided that CM's case and appellant's case were not closely related and did not abuse their discretion when coming to that conclusion. Thank you. The plain language of Article 66 states that the review of appellant's record should be contained to the entire record. However, appellant urges this court to deviate from the plain language and expand it to include these extra record materials that weren't put on the record until after the case was docketed with the CCA.
So under Jesse, there was this safety valve, so to speak, where if something was raised on the record but was not resolvable by the material that was in the record, there could be supplementation.
Yes, Your Honor.
So where is the appellant deficient in showing that it was raised on the record?
Your Honor, as appellant's argument stands now, the mere reference to any person on the record would give rise to a sentence comparison review, whereas this is the case where that sentence of that individual, of CM, was not raised.
Isn't that along the lines of the parade of imaginary horribles that somebody's going to get up there and read telephone book, if anybody remembers what a telephone book was like anymore? As compared to here, they're specifically saying this was a co-actor. So is that really a concern that someone's going to start throwing out names?
Your Honor, it's a possibility, but that's not the reason that this case does not fall under the Brennan line of precedent found in Jesse. The reason this case does not, or CM's case, or extra record material cases do not fall within the line of Brennan cases is because that sentence of CM had no bearing on the sentence that appellant in this case received, nor the appellant in any of those other cases receives, because it doesn't create an issue on the record for this court or the
CCA. That seems like a muddling of the two issues about whether there needs to be supplementation as compared to the second issue about Lacey. Now, in this instance, there was a discussion of CM at some length on the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here, the appellant had absolutely no control over when CM was sentenced. So there's not an issue of the timeliness on the part of the appellant or forfeiture issues or so forth. if the sentencing of CM had occurred either prior to appellant or prior to the clemency window closing, they would be able to, appellant would have been able to raise the issue. Doesn't this seem like a very arbitrary way to slam the door for an appellant to be able to show this issue?
No, Your Honor, it's not arbitrary when it conforms to the plain meaning of Article 66 and that it should be confined to the entire record. Furthermore,
But Jesse has defined what that means, and Jesse has the safety valve.
Jesse has the safety valve for the Brennan line of cases. However, this case falls under that first line of cases, the Fanyan line of cases, where a CCA's review should be limited to the entire record because the sentence does not raise an issue on the record. By virtue of the fact that, yes, it did occur after the case was heard at the trial level, but it's still the fact that this sentence had no bearing on what sentence appellant received or any sentence an appellant receives when the sentence isn't raised on the record for that particular appellant while they're at the trial level. Furthermore, for those two cases, in Jesse, this court specifically held that any further expansion, which the government argues this would be, of Jesse would render the restrictive language in Article 66 merely superfluous, where it wouldn't have any further bearing on the CCA's ability to review the entire record or the restriction to the entire record for the CCAs. And so Jesse would then create this other exception for sentence comparison lines of cases. And that arbitrariness was created simply from a judicial practice by the CCAs in conducting sentence comparison in the first place, rather than with conformity to Article 66.
So you're saying there's significant amount of precedence for the CCAs doing this?
There's a amount of precedent where the CCAs have come to the decision to, in closely related cases with highly disparate sentences, conduct this sentence comparison review. However, they did that contrary to the plain meaning of Article 66, which they are bound to as courts of statutory jurisdiction. They are bound to their authorizing statutes, and in this case, that they did not hold to those authorizing statutes, which feeds into those four principles of stare decisis, that the decision to engage in this practice is both poorly reasoned and unworkable. The fact that it's poorly reasoned can be found from the CCA's disregarding the plain language of Article 66 and erroneously developing what the defense in this case, an appellant in this case, is now calling a requirement for CCAs to engage in this sentence comparison practice. In Ballard, it specifically stated that it wasn't a requirement for the CCAs to engage in sentence comparison. Rather, it would be folly for them to not understand that judges coming to the appellate bench or the trial bench were not going to use their accumulated knowledge when coming to a decision whether or not a sentence was appropriate. So that goes to why that decision was poorly reasoned, in that it developed this type of process that leads to that arbitrariness where, yes, because appellant's case happened before CM's case, she says she did not raise it on the record. However, she had many appellants have the opportunity to raise things on the record, such as in their unsworn statements, knowing that this person is going to be sentenced in the future, knowing that the convening authority has a power over that person's case in the future, asking for sentence uniformity in that forum. Yet that didn't happen in this case, nor if it's being raised for the first time outside of the record at docketing with the CCA, is that the case for the specified issue from the court.
Hey, Captain, I'm sorry. Captain Hoff, I appreciate the government's interest in the CCA's workload, but have the lower courts themselves manifested, either through their opinions or in any other means, a suggestion that this is unworkable for them? I mean, it seems kind of odd that the government would be looking over at the CCA and saying, hey, this doesn't work for you all, this is unworkable, when the lower courts themselves don't seem to have a problem with applying the standards in the case law.
The CCAs have not explicitly stated that it is an overworkload for them. However, you can see from the practice of the CCAs that they're not conducting sentence comparison appropriately because they're not referring to the entire record. As this court found in Ballard, to truly compare cases, it goes beyond just the promulgating orders for those cases. You need to look at the entire record, all of the mitigating and extenuating or aggravating factors that come into play, how things developed on the record, the different case history there. And that's where it's unworkable, because the CCAs haven't been conducting that full record of trial review when conducting sentence comparison.
So your position, or the government's position, is, hey, look, if they're going to do it, then do it the right way and do all of it. Is that kind of the approach?
Yes, Your Honor, and if doing so, that would place a strain on the CCAs.
Counsel, I find this court and our predecessor's line of precedent in these cases a little hard to square sometimes with each other. I think that's indicated by both the fact that both parties are arguing stare decisis factors in their briefs. But I think the worst case for you is Brock. So how should we interpret, or how should we understand Brock in light of the other precedents in this line that from both our predecessor and from this court?
Yes, Your Honor, and that one is answered in two ways. First, Brock did not specifically address this extra record material question. Second, that through Jesse, that has abrogated or made that decision in Brock no longer good law. So this court should not follow what Brock did in that court in that case and make the CCAs consider that extra record material. The fact that the materials considered in that case were from a case that wasn't decided prior to Brock's trial being decided was not even noted until the case was remanded, and that's where the court noted, hey, these cases were not developed. This material is from this point in time, but they didn't even specifically reference that when coming to their decision that the cases weren't closely related. And similar to this current case, and another concern for the unworkability is that many times when individuals receive those low sentences, there's not a verbatim transcript out there for the CCAs to compare. So that unworkability is further compounded by that factor. In this case, CM would not have received a verbatim record, nor in Brock did that appellant receive, or that comparison case receive, that full verbatim transcript, and they were left with merely their service records to compare on that principle.
Do you think it's necessary for us to conclude that Jesse essentially abrogated Brock in order to straighten out the precedent in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Jesse, in coming to the determination that the Fanyan line of cases outside of the Brennan exception and outside of the Eighth Amendment and the Article 55 exceptions, that the CCAs were limited to the entire record in their reviews. Going to the intervening event, that the United States position is that the intervening event in the stare decisis principles is the court's decision in Jesse, which reaffirmed that the CCA should be looking to the entire record. And the reasonable expectations of service members are firmly met by holding the CCAs to the plain language of the statute. They're on notice of what the CCAs can consider and will be considering when their case is pending before them, rather than something that is judicially created. They can rely on the statute, and because a sentence appropriateness review still must be conducted under Article 66, which will not undermine the public confidence and instead ensure it's met, because as in this case where arguably CM received a light sentence, an inappropriately light sentence, an appellant is seeking the windfall of that inappropriately light sentence, it would be contrary to public confidence to allow appellants to be able to come back after they have already negotiated a plea agreement, after they have already agreed to certain sentence parameters, and their case is now pending before the CCA, to be able to go back and then change their minds and say, no, this person received a lighter sentence, I should receive that light sentence. Just because it's a light sentence does not mean it's a just sentence for those offenses that were committed. Which goes into...
Has there been such a case since this line of cases began? The one that you've just outlined in your example.
Your Honor, the one outlined in my example is...
Since with a life sentence.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, you just cited an example. Maybe I misunderstood. You just cited your example of a life sentence in which there's a sentence comparison issue that comes along. And my question is there, has such a case arisen yet?
Your Honor, it was a mispronunciation on my part, a light sentence.
I'm sorry.
And so with appellant receiving an arguably light sentence in this case, an inappropriately light sentence, and appellant saying that they should be granted the windfall of that inappropriately light sentence.
I got you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
But I do have another question, if you don't mind, Chief. I know you were getting ready.
No, go ahead.
I'm still interested in understanding what the government sees as an interest of its own that's being prejudiced. In other words, what ox does the government have that's being gored by the CCAs engaging in this practice of sentence comparison, whether they're doing it the way they do it now or whether they do it in the fashion the government says they should be?
Your Honor, I would say it's always in the United States' interest to ensure that CCAs are in compliance with the statutory requirements and their authorizing statutes. That is one principle of the United States, is to ensure that they are in compliance.
But they keep saying, or implicitly are saying, they are in keeping with their authority under Article 66.
Your Honor.
So why does the government have such an interest in fighting with them over that issue?
Your Honor, actually, the practice by the CCAs developed despite the language of Article 66. It was when they started the line of cases. It's one of the cases cited in Olinger, United States v. Perkins. In that case, they specifically cite that this is contrary to the plain meaning of Article 66, and they're engaging in this practice anyway, and that in doing so, that's going to be what they do in closely related and highly disparate cases. However, they specifically cite they are doing it in disregard for Article 66.
Thank you.
Towards the third point, Your Honor, the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals did not abuse its discretion when it found that CM's case and appellant's cases were not closely related under the standards in Lacey.
And that's the only thing I was going to ask. You were talking about this hypothetical windfall that would result. Was there a windfall in this case?
Your Honor, no, there was not a windfall because they found that the cases were not closely related. And in doing so, they didn't abuse their discretion because they are given a wide latitude under Lacey to determine whether or not individuals are co-actors engaged in a common or parallel scheme or whether or not there is another direct nexus.
Can you point to any cases in the past where there's been a real windfall to an appellant where the CCAs have permitted the record to be supplemented?
Your Honor, I cannot point to a specific case in the past.
Thank you.
In this present case, they did not abuse their discretion because they based it on rational factors. In their decision, they were not arbitrary or fanciful when they determined that because of CM and appellant not engaging in this common scheme or parallel scheme for two of the offenses, the two most serious offenses, based on the amount of confinement that the judge ruled in this case for those two offenses. These were the most egregious offenses he found. And it was otherwise noted on the record that appellant had lied under oath to the military judge when she stated that she had fraudulently enlisted in the Air Force based on the recommendation of the recruiter. The government then brought that recruiter to testify that no, he had never told her to lie in her enlistment paperwork. And the CCA even noted that in their own decision in coming to the conclusion that appellant's sentence was overall appropriate because sentence comparison is but one aspect of a sentence appropriateness review. So overall, the CCA conducted a sentence appropriateness review, considered CM's case despite the fact that they found it not closely related to appellant's case, and determined that appellant received the correct sentence based on her repeated lies and repeated drug abuse while in the Air Force. And Your Honors, barring any further questions, I will briefly conclude.
I have one question. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I think appellant's counsel would argue that sentence uniformity is one of the fundamental purposes of Article 66. Does the government have a response to that assertion?
Your Honor, the United States agrees that sentence uniformity is one of the principles of Article 66 and why it's there. However, that sentence uniformity comes from the military judges in their accumulated experience, the different minimums and maximums allowed for specific offenses, and it comes from the individualized consideration, because that is also a very big factor under Article 66, is that individualized consideration rather than a formulaic or arithmetically averaged sentence comparison.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Hoff. Major Blythe.
Thank you, Your Honor. And we're not asking this court today to deviate from precedent or to do anything different than what's already recognized in Jesse and in the Brennan line of precedent. And to that point, with the Brennan line of precedent, we've made the parallel with IAC, with ineffective assistance of counsel. And one of the important things there is sometimes there's very little in the record for ineffective assistance of counsel, and that is a sufficient hook in order for the court to receive affidavits and potentially order a Dubé hearing to get full clarity on those issues. Another point on the interpretation of Brennan, every CCA that we looked at that had evaluated the issue of whether post-docketing sentence comparison fell under the Brennan line of precedent held that it did. In terms of Ballard, the government has some language from Ballard about how the difficulty of comparing cases based on just the promulgating order. But the important thing in Ballard is a case about a military judge with an apparently harsh sentencing pattern. There's no relationship between the cases other than that was the judge providing the sentences. And the appellant there wanted to make the point that this judge was harsh, and the court said, well, it's difficult for us with just a promulgating order to understand what's going on in these other cases. In terms of a verbatim transcript, it's true that sometimes that may not be provided. That didn't obstruct this court in Durant when it had only a summarized record of trial that it used in order to compare cases and find there was a rational basis in Durant for the disparity in the offenses. The government calls it an inappropriately light sentence for CM. The government has a mechanism to appeal sentences and did not. In terms of stare decisis, one important principle when applying stare decisis for statutory interpretation, that interpretation is strongest with regard to statutes, especially when you have long congressional acquiescence. Congress has made virtually no changes over the entire life of the code to the relevant portions of Article 66. So that long congressional acquiescence plays into, enhances the stare decisis effect for the case.
So, Major Blythe, are you saying that because Congress has not addressed the fact that the CCAs have embellished, I don't want to say deviated, their review under Article 66 by doing sentence comparisons, that that's the congressional acquiescence? Or are you saying because Congress has not significantly changed the language of this provision that Congress has acquiesced in it? I'm just trying to pin where you're saying the congressional acquiescence is occurring.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think Congress has had numerous chances over the years to revise Article 66 as recently as the Military Justice Act of 2016. It has not made a significant change. If there was an issue with the way the CCAs or this court were engaging in sentence comparison, Congress had the opportunity to fix that and has never chosen to do so. So I think that just adds greater force to the statutory, to the stare decisis effect that Congress has never chosen to intervene to do that. And in a sense, that's why we argue that this effectively becomes part of the statutory scheme over time. And the government makes the point that this is something that started with the CCAs and bubbled its way up. Well, that makes sense because sentence appropriateness is the province of the CCAs. This is unlikely to be something that where the origin lies at this court, because primarily it is the CCAs that are engaging in sentence appropriateness review. And as to what the actual abuse of discretion is, we think it's the Air Force Court acting with a misunderstanding of Lacey, that there was a requirement of total overlap in the offenses as opposed to an abuse of discretion because of the way that they weighed the factors. I see my time is expiring. We ask this court to allow appellants to continue post-docketing sentence comparison, consistent with Jesse, and in this case, to find the Air Force Court abused its discretion.
Any further questions?
Can I get one question? I think you argue that this case does fall under the second bucket of Jesse because the issue is raised by the record, right? What is enough? What is, under your view, what is the trigger? What is the threshold that has to exist in the record for this to qualify under the second Is it just the mentioning of someone? Does there have to be a description of their acts? I'm just curious, in your view, what is the threshold that has to be passed?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is not, as the government says, just a mere passing mention of a name. I think we use the phrase prima facie case, and that came from the concurrence in one of the cases, where basically the appellant has the burden to show enough facts within the record of trial that establish some, that the case are closely related, there's a direct nexus that would at least demonstrate that there is a means to overlap in terms of the misconduct. So I think it has to be fairly substantial. That falls within the abuse of discretion standard for the Air Force, for the CCAs to decide how much is enough. We just don't think this is a close case on how much is enough. There are close cases out there. We just don't think this is it.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:25.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:25.